Good afternoon. Thanks, Antoine and Louis, for the invitation, and also thanks for organizing this wonderful meeting. And what I'm going to talk today about is resonant X-ray, all done at the copper edge, similar to what you've seen this morning. And the emphasis is, we've done a lot of work on the hole side of the phase diagram, but what I like to do is compare the hole with the electron side of the phase diagram. And in doing so, I'll touch upon some of the most recent finding on the hole side. There are a lot of people to acknowledge, a lot of collaborators, many of them within the Quantum Biorad Institute, which doesn't only include UBC people, but also Bernard Kaimer, Mathieu here from Max Planck, or Jenny Hoffman for Harvard. In particular, I'd like to mention one student, Ricardo Comin, who has been the man behind most of this work. So, and in fact, let me say that he's a force of nature, and if anybody was interested in hiring a junior professor in the area of scattering, it would be an excellent candidate. And the second one is Eduardo Silvaneto, who worked with Yazdani, STM before, and now is with us doing STM. Also like to mention many other people from outside the Quantum Biorad Institute, and in particular, we have Yoroshi Izaki for the BISCO 2201, we have Rick Green from University of Maryland for NCCO, the electron dope cuprates, and most recently, Martin Graven with more samples on the electron dope side. I'd like to just mention a couple of words about the early work of Ricardo, the one on BISCO 2201, which was an effort where we tried to combine three techniques, resonant X-ray, STM, and at the same time, angle-resolved photoemission through a comparison with the fermiology. And the idea was really that of trying to see if you could take a material where you could use both surface and bulk-sensitive technique, real space and momentum space, and obtain a coherent set of data. And in fact, things work out very well. We have a peak in resonant X-ray, the Q vector where the CDW, the charge order, has been seen, also in YBCL, comparable values. And if we take the STM map, we can also do a Fourier transform, and again find the peak of the very same Q vector. So this really establishes the convergence of the two techniques on the same material. We have also looked at the temperature dependence of these peaks, of the onset temperature of this peak and the temperature evolution. We've done it for a number of doping values, and we have compared is the soft offset that we see in the resonant X-ray with the T star as determined on the samples, these particular samples, by night shift measurement. These are the bars that you can see here. And one phenomenology that appears on the whole dope side is that usually T star, the pseudogap temperature, is much higher than the onset of the charge order. In the case of BISCO 2201, the two appear to be coincident. I'll come back to this. I still feel like this cannot be called, truly a phase transition. And what you can see is this very, very soft onset. The other point was that of connecting to the fermiology, and in particular, look at the evolution versus all doping of the charge ordering wave vector. And the point we were making here are the data from this particular work, STM and resonant X-ray. The point that we're making here is that the Q vector that we see experimentally actually match the location of the tip of the Fermi arcs. This is now shown on the basis of a simulation, but this simulation actually reproduces the photoemission data of the same compound. So these Q vector really do not connect the very antinodal portion of the underlying single particle Fermi surface. I want to make one point clear here. We refer to the point shot here explicitly, but this is not to really provide any direct support to a specific hotspot theory, hotspot model. Really, in this case, we are more concentrating on the experimental location of the tip of the Fermi arcs, which in this particular case also coincide with a hotspot for that particular Fermi surface. But that may or may not be a specific properties of the material one is looking at. What we also have done is to then plot on the same graph a number of other results. You have here YBCO data, the triangle, don't quite match, but definitely are far away from a line corresponding to the antinode. Interestingly, the BISCO 2212 data, this is work by Eduardo Yazdani, actually follow the same line. And again, you have for mercury compound, Martin Graven's work, a point which again falls on the same line. So my point here is really to emphasize the evolution of the Q vector with doping, which is opposite to the one seen on the lanthanum-based cuprates. It does follow the evolution of the Fermi surface, meaning you're doping more holes. So the whole cylinder is increasing, and so the distance is between the Fermi arc tips, as also Seamus has shown on the STM data, is decreasing, and this is pretty much what you're following here. One important point of that work was really that of connecting two approaches, the bulk from resonant X-ray and the surface from STM, and by taking one simple material, we're basically validating the large amount of work that came primarily from Seamus's group, but also others, which have been there for many, many years on a number of materials. So this really establishes, you know, this phenomenology as a universal phenomenology, at least for the whole dope side of a phase diagram. One point I'd like to mention before moving on is that of, which has come up already this morning, is how long range order is this? Is it really phase translation? So here are the results in Q space now, Horizon X-ray for three compounds, LBCO, YBCO, and BiSCO2201. What you're seeing here is the evolution of the, what we call the charge density wave peak, going from the very intense and also very coherent. So if you look at a, you know, a real space image of the case of the LBCO, to the very incoherent and very low intense peak that we observe in the case of BiSCO2201. Correlation length of the order of 20 to 30 angstrom in this case. So now the question, of course, is this a truly phase transition? Well, you're lacking, obviously, a long-range order. Still, we wanted to know what else can we learn with resonant X-ray, looking, zooming into these peaks and see whether we can learn about the symmetry of this order. So 1D versus 2D was one question, and the second question was D wave versus S wave symmetry. So this brings me now to the second paper of Ricardo, who was just published a few days ago, and which is the one where we believe we actually can resolve this question and really talk about stripe. But of course, I want to emphasize this is a charge stripe order, so we are not looking at magnetism. We have no associated magnetic order here. The idea is the following. The idea, I wanted to really simplify as much as possible the idea of this experiment, which is to imagine that we have in real space a domain, a certain patch, in this case an isotropic domain, circular domain, with a one-dimensional charge modulation. In Q space, this will give you a peak along the particular axis that the modulation is running along, so along the QX axis in this case, and this peak would have a width, and the width relates to 1 over the correlation length of a domain itself. Things get more complicated if one makes the domain of an irregular shape, meaning that the correlation length along the y direction is longer than along the x direction. So now your peak loses the spherical symmetry, the circular symmetry becomes an ellipsoid, and in one side broader than the other. And if you had two such domains superimposed, meaning on the same plane or in different planes, you would double up this kind of structure. Well, what is important is if you have a checkerboard-like instability, and you retain this shape of a domain, of course you're now going to get out of the very same domain two peaks simultaneously. But both peaks are going to have the same, they relate back to the same correlation length. So they have to have the same shape pretty much. And this is one defining feature of a checkerboard order versus a stripe order. So the checkerboard order imposes the same structure for both peaks at Q0 and 0Q. If I had two separate one-dimensional domains with opposite orientation for the charge stripe, those two peaks would not have to respect this particular relation. So then the situation that we describe is something similar to this case. We have Q space, where we have along one direction the chain peaks, and then we have the our Bragg peaks, but we also have the four charge order wave vectors, the four charge order peaks that we observe on most of the samples. And the two kinds of scenarios we'd like to discuss or describe are these ones. And in this case, we put down the domains being elongated along the same direction, but that doesn't have to be the case, actually. So the key point is, going back to these images, the Q space images, so and there, see or whether or not we find a situation where the two peaks along the two different axes have exactly the same properties. And this, again, is in testing this property of a checkerboard. If the checkerboard is there, the structure factor of the two places has to be identical. In order to do that, we have to probe both peaks. And that already raises one first difficulty, though, which is not only we want to probe both peaks, but we want to really look at the full symmetry in Q space of those two peaks. So usually, we are used to cut a peak along this direction. What Ricardo has come up with is a scheme by rotating a sample on a wedge sample holder in order to be able to go through the peak, cutting that peak along different directions. So basically, he's doing something like a tomographic measurement where he has one-dimensional slices of a peak, and there you can follow, as you rotate, the evolution of the line width, and then you reconstruct the shape of a peak in Q space. And as you can see, what you get is an ellipsoidal telling you there must be some domain structure, and then you can do the same measurement for the other Q vector. And so now you have two ellipsoidal, and the key question is, are these two objects identical or not? And so would they support the checkerboard symmetry breaking? This has been done for a number of samples, and you clearly see that there is a doping evolution going from more underdoped to less underdoped. And one key point that stands out is, in all cases, you're breaking C4 symmetry. But as I mentioned, this C4 symmetry, so basically if you rotate one onto the other, you don't obtain the same shape, or the shape, you know, even the same orientation of the peaks. But that is not a sufficient condition to claim in favor of a stripe state. Instead, what really is important is that none of the cases we find two peaks that have exactly the same characteristic, meaning the same correlation length along the two directions of a peak for both crystallographic axes. And this is what allows us to conclude in favor of a one-dimensional charge stripe for the breaking of symmetry at the microscopy level, as opposed to a checkerboard state. And again, one key aspect I'd like to mention here is this is done at one single L value, so it's in, you know, we're not following the L dependence, so the C axis dependence, so how things are stacked along that plane, but we are observing peaks along both directions, and so this is just a check for the symmetry of those peaks, independent of their intensity, just in terms of the shape, and if you had this kind of geometry, this kind of symmetry breaking, that rule would have to be obeyed. So not seeing that is sufficient conditions to claim that the symmetry breaking has to be one-dimensional in nature. A key element is that in order to figure this out, one really has to look at the two-dimensional structure factor along both directions and fully resolving for each peak the shape of the object. Let me now move to the next question, which is the one of D-wave versus S-wave. And this has been a long effort, and Seamus has shown some of the early work. What I'm going to show here is a little bit different because this has gone through revisions and has been now, data have been reanalyzed in a number of ways. And I'd like to mention, in fact, David Hawthorne and his student are also now co-authors of this work, and so where we try to combine forces to come with a unified picture. So the idea was going back to work done by Subir, Sachdev, where you can try to write down a parameter description, a symmetry description for the charge density wave, where you have different components, where you have charge basically being modulated over the copper site primarily, or being modulated over oxygen sites. Again, we have seen it in the previous talk with Seamus. And one key element also within, once the charge is on the bonds, is whether the modulation of the charge is in phase with the plaquette or out of phase. In this case, it's out of phase, and this is the dance that Seamus was referring to. And in the case of the S prime, charge modulation on a plaquette is actually in phase. So the idea was now to use the same approach, so rotate the samples, so basically focus in this case of one of the two charge-oriented Q vectors or peaks, and in fact you can do it for both, and focus on this, and as you rotate the sample, measure the evolution of intensity. So these plots here are showing the peak as a function of alpha. Alpha is this azimuthal angle, and so what you're seeing is a modulation of intensity. Before, we were looking at the width, so the evolution of the width of the peaks, which is an intrinsic property independent of this effect, but the intensity is also being modulated. And the intensity modulation just depends on the fact that as you rotate your sample, the polarization of the orientation of the polarization of the light with respect to the samples and therefore to the orbitals is changing, and so you are probing different components of that resonant excitation that you are involving in the process. So what we can then do is we can look at the intensity in resonant X-ray, we can modulate that as a modulus square of an object which contains the scattering factor sandwiched between the incoming and outgoing polarization. The idea then is to go and model the scattering vector now, and that's where the difference is with respect to the first version of this paper. Instead of modeling this scattering vector, the scattering tensor in terms of specific transition along the x-axis, y-axis, or z-axis, we're actually simply modeling this now in terms of the different and possible symmetries of a charge order. So the S symmetry, an S prime symmetry, or a D wave symmetry, and the deltas basically only represent the amplitude of these different components, of the three different components. So what we're doing then, we are modulating the scattering factor tensor this way, and then we can go and model the intensity we measure, basically pretty much this evolution as a function of alpha, in terms of such a model, and see which one of these deltas are actually the ones you need in order to be able to reproduce the signal. These are two data sets. These are both on YBCO, 6.51 or 6.75. And what you're seeing is, as a function of the azimuthal angle, you're seeing some signal. These are the circles, the symbols. And the symbols is the resonant X-ray intensity, but now normalized, meaning divided for sigma and pi polarization. And so now what you're trying to do is to see whether you can reproduce this evolution of a signal of intensity with one of the models. And here you see two different analyses. The dashed lines are an analysis where in that scattering tensor we keep into account S and S prime components only. And the solid lines are for S plus D or S prime plus D. And in fact, we're not able to distinguish between S plus D and S prime plus D. They basically are equivalent in our analysis. The key is the position of the minima. In a system where you only have S and S prime symmetry involved for the charge order, the position of the minima is exactly at 90 degrees. So, and that's what you see in the dashed line. Experimentally, what we observe in all these YBCO samples is always a shift of the minimum with respect to the 90 degree. In fact, we find the minimum more around 100, 110 degrees. And so it's that shift that basically dictates that the best agreement here is found now for a D wave, a predominantly D wave bond order. And in fact, when I say predominantly in this particular case, for this analysis, you're looking at 70% D wave and 30% S prime or S wave. I have to say that this is one thing, though, that would be perhaps also dependent on the particular L you're looking at. So these precise numbers will need to be verified by doing, for instance, a full detailed L dependence, because different L may give you more or less sensitivity to one order with respect to the other. And we have done some of that, and basically this is what comes out. So summarizing all of this work, what we get is we have a prominent D-wave symmetry in YBCO. For BISCO2201, we are not really able to conclude or get a strong conclusion in favor of one or the other order. So in the previous analysis we had done, relying on parameters, we were able to come to a conclusion. But when we do an analysis purely based on symmetry, which is the strength of this new way of analyzing the data, we are not able for 2201 to come to a firm conclusion. But again, I also heard from Jenny that similar, basically she's done the work similar to what you've done on BISCO2212. And she finds the same, pretty much the same result on 2201. So I think there, you know, you probably have more sensitivity there to conclude. One has to keep in mind that in our case, the YBCO data are the best possible data we can get, while the 2201, as you've seen before, have very little intensity, peaks are very broad, so everything becomes very difficult for us. Finally, I'd like to mention, again, work done by David Hawthorne and his group. Now, on LBCO, LBCO, as we've said, you know, lanthanum cuprates appear to be different as far as the Q vector, evolution of the Q vector, magnetism being associated with it, and structure too. In this case, actually, what is similar is also in that case, we come up with a predominant bond order. So the role of the oxygen, also in LBCO, is the predominant one. But what they conclude for LBCO is an S prime symmetry as a dominant one, as opposed to a D plus S or so. Well, this is all I wanted to say for the whole dope side. Next step is now to move in the electron dope side and see really what can you learn there and you know, learn from this comparison. The first question, of course, was can you actually observe a similar charge order in your electron dope side? And this is work now of Eduardo. And the idea was that perhaps one shouldn't observe it because there are clear differences in the phase diagram, the very large range of antiferromagnetism, the very particular pseudo gap. And as a starting point, also a very strong difference or a nice asymmetry between whole dope systems where you are doping into the oxygen 2p band as opposed to the electron system, dope system where you're now going to the copper upper band. One point of commonality, though, as far as charge ordering and how charge ordering was first brought up, is that as you observe quantum oscillation on the hole dope side, you also observe quantum oscillation on the electron dope side. So the experiment then was done by Eduardo, and pretty much approaching as we did on 2201, which means same parameters, same copper edge, same Q vector, immediately a peak was found. It's a resonant peak, so these are two different samples, so you see a resonant peak on both, and so that immediately tells you that, you know, you're looking at a similar phenomenology. The next step was to really look at the width of these peaks, again for two different samples. We have now better data. So in this case, for instance, we come up with the correlation length of 32 angstroms. So it's again pretty short, comparable to Biscotto 201. The next step was also, again, to look at whether there is any particular connection to the fermiology. And again, let me say here, I'm not a strong proponent of a hotspot theory. I'm not a strong proponent that there should be a nesting, but this is the first thing to do just in terms of what is the connection between the experimental Q vectors and the low chi of low energy excitations in Q in momentum space. And what you find in this case is that the Q vector pretty much is connecting now what look like would be the electron pocket of a Fermi surface, if that had to be the folding, or anyway, regions which are again close to the crossing between the Fermi surface and the anti-Fermi zone boundary. Finally, the additional point that was in the particular study was to look at the temperature dependence, again, for only two doping, so close to optimal doping for the electron doped side. And what you're seeing here is now that comes as a strong difference with respect to the whole dope group rates. What you're seeing, yeah, thanks. A much larger temperature scale. So it's hard with this data to really find a precise onset, but we affect, and I'll show you better data in a moment, but what we could conclude back then was that at 350, 300 Kelvin, that's roughly when you start seeing that onset, is again this very soft onset. But if you now try to go and compare this onset for the charge ordering to the pseudogap temperature, well, that is shown here in Martin Graven's work. The pseudogap temperature is the dashed line connecting this white dot. The white circles are coming from optical measurements. And our onset here for optimal doping is around 300 Kelvin. The T star for this same doping is around 70, 80 Kelvin. So there is a large, large difference where, if anything, the charge ordering seem to be following the onset of anti-Fermi fluctuations. In fact, this blue shaded area is the onset of a finite correlation length in elastic scattering. So this basically shows a similar phenology as far as the Q vectors and as far as correlation length, but very different as far as temperature. Let me now show the latest data that we just obtained in the last few weeks. These are now samples from Martin Graven's group, and the idea was really to go and use the same sample to see whether we could follow the onset in temperature for the different sample he has already studied by the inelastic scattering. And what we see are here some representative data points from 10% doping to 15, 16. And what you're seeing now is a much better quality of data. But one thing which is remarkable in all these samples, there is some temperature here between 340 and 300 where the temperature dependence seems to saturate. There is no further temperature dependence, but clearly there is still a structure. And this structure is, again, the broad feature. These are, again, correlation length of the order of 30 angstrom or a bit longer, perhaps. But that structure doesn't seem to evolve in temperature beyond a certain point, but it is there. And so that raises the issue of whether we're looking at something being or not being pinned by disorder in this system. As you go down in temperature, the intensity increases, peaks get sharper, and this is what we are looking at as a temperature evolution. And you can go and look at that as a function of doping. We can then go back to our phase diagram and impose on what was the picture from the inelastic scattering our new data point for the temperature dependence. Before we had looked at close to optimal doping, we were having a slightly higher temperature onset. Here we have much better quality of the data. And if we look at when the signals saturate, this is what we put down as a red symbol on this plot. And pretty much, I'm not sure if you give any meaning to this inflection, but I would say that pretty much you're seeing at a constant temperature evolution for this charge order over a very large doping range, which is actually beyond where superconductivity is. In this case, the range where you observe this feature is much wider than the superconducting dome itself, which of course raises the question of what suppresses the superconducting dome. The other interesting point is that we have now a point where down to 4% where the charge density, charge order is really gone. So there is absolutely no peak, no structure in the spectra left. Finally, the last point is to look at the Q dependence. So now we have a Q dependence as a function of doping for a number of samples. And what you're seeing here is something that increases with doping. And you have to keep in mind now you're doping with electrons. So your Fermi surface is counting holes. So the whole cylinder is getting smaller and smaller. And so these Q vectors are scaling pretty much as the distance between the, let's say, antinodal segment of the Fermi surface in this case. And in fact, this can be compared to data obtained by two groups in light gray. This is data from Peter Armitage. back from the ZX Shen's time, and in dark gray now you have data from Matsui, and what you see is that pretty much you are, you know, within error, but following each other very, very well. So similar to what you see on the Hall dope side, also on the electron dope side, the Q vector scales with the volume of the Fermi surface, whatever that means, if you like. So this brings me to the conclusions. On the Hall dope side, as a full study, we have looked at particular, you know, the evolution with temperature, but especially connecting bulk and surface, and then looking at the evolution of the Q vectors and see what they actually connect. And they connect the tips of the Fermi arcs, at least LISCON 2201, where we have a detailed study of the Fermi arc tips. And we also look at the internal symmetry of this order, concluding in favor of a D-wave, predominantly D-wave bond order, and one-dimensional symmetry breaking. And finally, when we go to the comparison with the electron dopes, we find many of the similar features, same Q vectors, same correlation length, same evolution of the Fermi surface. What really stands out is this temperature evolution that we have seen here. And in terms of, one key question I personally have is, given the asymmetry of the electronic structure, then I wonder whether would we observe on the electron dope side, cuprates, also a bond center kind of order, or should we instead see a size center, given that here we are really dealing now with electrons on the copper. And so for two questions to me remain as burning question, outstanding question. One is, what is the role of the MUF physics here, the details of the MUF physics? It looks like in this phenomenon, that doesn't seem to be playing at all. I just wonder whether this would come out the moment you were able to look in detail at the symmetry of the charge order. And the second one, of course, is whether charge order is a concomitant or not phenomenon with high temperature superconductivity, which I would have said has to be. Again, the most recent electron dope data raised some concerns there, given that you see charge order over such a broad doping range as compared to superconductivity. And with this, I'd like to thank you.
Thank you, Andrea.